Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where the royal buttocks of myth meet the red-hot poker of truth. And welcome to another of our live specials from the Gloucester History Festival, coming to you from the picture postcard setting of Blackfriars Priory. And letting his blood pressure down for this episode, I am joined by Fellow of the Royal Historical Society and Fellow of the Society of Antiquities and author of the Sunday Times best-selling Time Traveller's Guides, Ian Mortimer. Ian, welcome to History Rage.
Thank you very much for asking me.
You are welcome, sir. Do you think you can get angry?
My anger is cold. After this many years, it is like a razor belly.
Well, before we get into lowering your blood pressure and doing historian therapy then, just wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your background, the books that you've worked on in the past, and the book that you're here and promoting at the Gloucester History Festival.
Yeah, going back, I have always been a historian since before I could remember. I always say to people, my great advantage is that I was a historian at a childlike age. Well, I was very, in the way that musicians can know their scales from a very young age, that was my advantage. I knew all the kings and queens from a very young age. I qualified as an archivist. I qualified as a historian. My PhDs in social history and medicine in the 17th century. I write on medicine. I write on everything to do with society. I write the Time Traveller's Guide to Medieval England and Elizabethan England and Restoration Britain and Regency Britain. I've written political biographies. I've even written a book about running. I've written fiction. I've written academia. I've written very accessible material. My guiding light is evidence. Mm. Without evidence, there is no history. And if there is evidence, why shouldn't a historian write on the subject? My limitations, therefore, are set by the evidence that I understand.
Yeah. And you've got a new book out there, which you are
Medieval promoting. Horizons, which is about how virtually everybody misunderstands the Middle Ages.
Oh, you're fitting well here, I'd say.
Yeah, well, Middle Ages. Yeah, even experts. It's an interesting fact that even experts will deliberately misrepresent the Middle Ages because they're often working with their audiences. And the audience comes to the Middle Ages that everything bad is medieval, everything good is Renaissance, and therefore we will have this sort of fiction that many professors of history work with. And as I said in my talk a moment ago, you know, you have very well-known names just trying to gloss over the period as if before technology there was nothing really important in society or nothing changed important in society. Well, I point out that Leonardo was older than Richard III. We always think of Richard III as a medieval king. Or why don't we think of Leonardo da Vinci as a medieval genius? And when you look at Leonardo's works, well, he's quoting Roger Bacon, an English friar. It was a 13th century man from a friary like this.
Yeah.
Why don't we actually realize that the birth of modern culture is a medieval phenomenon? Shakespeare often is said to speak for us, even though he knew nothing about the technology of the last 500 years, 400 years, whereas he doesn't speak for the people 500 years before his time who were, you know, unthinking by comparison.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you very much. So let's dive into the particular topic that you're coming at us today, one that's been crawling at your soul for the last 20 years at very least.
Yep.
So will you please tell our baying mob of history ragers out there what is the one historical thing you wish everyone would just stop believing?
That Edward II died in Berkeley Castle on or about the 21st of September 1327. It's often been said, it's been said that he did since the 24th of September 1327, but it's not true.
Really?
True.
Okay. So let's start that off then, because we, first of all, if you give us the traditional narrative of the death of Edward II in 1327.
The traditional narrative, whether you hear the Red Hot Poker story or otherwise, basically says that Edward II died in a certain room. The room is flagged up by the Berkeley family as the death place. In just on one side of the keep of Berkeley Castle. He was imprisoned there, no doubt about that. We have records for him being looked after there. The traditional account is that he was done to death in order to basically end his reign. His reign was already over. He had abdicated in favour of his son. But he was done to death to stop him being rescued by a plot that was forming in North Wales at the time. And that he was murdered on the orders of my namesake, Roger Mortimer. And that the deed was carried out by Lord Berkeley and John Maltravers, his keepers. And this has passed through generations. I mean, it's been said to be the case ever since September 1327. And is generally said by every senior academic that I know to this day that although we might not know the particulars, we can generally assume that he died in Berkeley Castle on or about the 21st of September of 1327.
I always have a bit of a trouble with that we can generally assume creeping that's, into yeah, any. Yeah.
That is generally what academics will tell you. The story of the Red Hot Poker crops up for the first time in the 1330s. It first mentioned as a copper rod in a chronicle called the Extension of the Brute Chronicle, which was probably first written at York. Not entirely certain about that, but after 1333. This, by 1340, had become a red hot poker. It appears in Ranulf Higden's Polychronicon as a red hot poker by 1340. Edward III was obviously somewhat startled to find that his father was being spoken about as having had a red hot poker stuck up his backside. And that being the mode of killing him. And he asked for Ranulf Higden to come from his monastery in Cheshire, I think it was in Chester, to come to London with his chronicle and show him what he was writing. So, but we don't know what Edward III thought about this story. But generally, the story has developed and it's become a sort of icon, I suppose, the Middle Ages, that this king, this great man, was brought so low and then killed in such a foul manner.
And so you're challenging this view, not just of the Red Hot Poker story, but you're also challenging the view that Edward II actually dies at that point in that place. Yeah. So how does your research challenge that?
Okay, this is a little bit of a complicated story because of the pushback I've received, it has had to develop. So it's worth actually looking through where I got to the point at which I thought, right, now we go for the kill. So I started off with a biography of Roger Mortimer, who was the first Earl of March, who was the man in charge at the time. And if you're writing the biography of a man who supposedly killed a king, you have to decide whether you're going to support this or not. Are you going to write the story of a king killer, or are you going to write a much weaker story about somebody who might have killed the king? Yeah, you really have to sort of decide. And in the course of researching that book, which is called The Greatest Traitor, I obviously encountered all of the data everybody else had already come across, which includes a letter which was discovered in 1877 in France, which gives a narrative for Edward II's survival, which everybody had always dismissed. And I looked at why people had dismissed this letter. It's by a man called Manuela Fieschi, who was the secretary to a Cardinal Luca Fieschi, one of the most important and powerful clergyman in the whole of Europe. And I looked at this and I realized that there are lots of things that don't really add up. For a start, the Earl of Kent in 1330, who was Edward II's half-brother, was sentenced to death and executed for trying to release him from Corfe Castle and make him king again. Now, historians traditionally have made excuses for the Earl of Kent saying he was stupid. Well, he was also the leader of the commander of the English forces in France. He was entrusted with command of an army. Everybody looked at him as being a valorous knight. No one referred to him as being stupid, apart from historians trying to explain why he tried to rescue. So that didn't really add up for me. So I thought I'd look at this in a new light. And then the crunch point came late in the morning on the 7th of December 2001, as I was sitting in my study. And picture me here in a second floor attic room, books all around me, open.
Shut just, away from social
exactly,
skills.
Exactly, yeah, completely. With an 18th century copy of the Rotuli Parliamentorum on the floor in front of me, and looking there and realizing there is a huge inconsistency in the way that Edward III proceeded against the people who supposedly killed his father. Two men were responsible for keeping the king, ex-king, safely in Berkeley Castle. Only one of them was prosecuted for failing in that duty. Either the king was protecting the other one, or he wasn't involved. The king certainly wasn't protecting him, because he had him condemned to death. There were inconsistencies like this that showed that Edward III didn't actually believe his father had died, whatever.
Yeah. So,
at the same time, in 1330, November 1330, Lord Berkeley, who was one of the people who was meant to be keeping the ex-king safely, when asked in Parliament how he wished to acquit himself of responsibility for the death, said, "I haven't heard that the man is dead yet." He actually said in Latin, or it's reported in Latin, he probably spoke in French, but it's recorded in Latin as, "I have not heard about his death until coming into this present Parliament." Now, when you had Lord Berkeley, who was responsible, saying, "I haven't heard he's dead yet," Edward III not deciding that the people responsible had failed in their duties, I thought there was a good enough case to look again at the Fieschi letter and say, well, this evidence that he went to France, to Avignon, and then was taken to Italy should be considered seriously. And it includes a lot of things that you couldn't show, people wouldn't have known about unless they had been Edward II.
Mm-hmm.
And also this came directly from the Edward II character, because Manuel Fieschi writing it said he has come to Avignon, he met him. So this is not, I've heard reports, this is actually him meeting the ex-king in Avignon. So in The Greatest Traitor, I went with the story that the ex-king really had survived 1327, and that the outline of the Fieschi was probably broadly true, and that he had ended his days under the command of the Fieschi family in northern Italy. So I stuck this into the end of The Greatest Traitor. Academics liked the book, hated that point about it. Oh, we can dismiss, they all said. In fact, there was ex-archivist, ex-county archivist of Gloucestershire Archives, a man called David Smith, who did a radio program with me, I think about 2 or 3 days after the book had come out. He hadn't looked at my book. He just presumed that I was taking the Fieschi letter for granted and basing everything on that, which is exactly what I hadn't done. And this is the point I would get angry. Because what I'd done meticulously was work out the basis for us believing why the man had died, and then look at the Fieschi letter as a separate matter. You can always argue about a single document. You can always say this isn't true. Anybody can do that with a single document, and there are plenty of medieval forgeries that allow people to dismiss letters, rightly or wrongly, because they don't agree with them. But what you can't do is take multiple streams of knowledge and say they all point in the same direction, and then just dismiss those. You can't do that. And that's where I got a bit angry, because I've been very careful to separate the survival story from the fact the man had not been killed. The two are not, they seem directly connected, but you have to approach the death and why we think he was killed or died separately before you then look at what happened afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I stuck all this into A Greatest Traitor. And when I got this pushback from archivists like David Smith and academics who want to dismiss the story because they all believed the Fieschi letter was a work of an imposter, I went back to the drawing board. And since I was trained as an archivist, I've got 4 degrees in history, so I'm as well qualified as anybody who wants to talk on this subject.
More than most, in fact.
Well, yeah, I didn't want to point that out, but thank you for doing so.
You're welcome. That's why I'm here.
I thought, right, I'm going to do the complete job on this. Taking my watchword from Watergate scandal, who knew what and when they knew it? We have good enough records in this country. We can occasionally reconstruct patterns of information flow. And going back to the whole thing all over again and examining everything, all the primary material available, I came across Well, actually, I'd already come across the letter. I realised the significance of a document in the National Archives. DL10/253.
Oh, sounds like a page turner already, doesn't it?
God, the DL10/253 really, well, it changed my life in many ways. Mm. Two things were real catalysts here. One was an old archaeologist called Raleigh Radford died and left his entire library to Exeter University Library. Any duplicates they offered to staff, I happened to walk home with a set of most of archaeologia and opened it one day to realize that when kings were buried, they were entirely covered in wax seer cloth until Edward II's time. After Edward II, they had their faces showing. Up to Edward II's time, no, they were covered in seer cloth. That accidental discovery as a result of that man leaving that library was one really good insight. And the other one was DL10/253. DL10/253 is a letter from Edward III to his cousin, who was then on the north border, dated at Lincoln on the 24th of September 1327, saying, I heard in the night just gone, during the last night, that my father has died. Mm-hmm. Secure the northern border. When monarchs die, there was a lack of command, perceived to be a lack of command, so you had to secure the ports, secure the borders. And this original letter survives. And it proves that Edward III gave the order in complete faith that his father was dead on the 24th, the same day, as we know from the Rochester Chronicle, that he had announced to the people who just attended Parliament that his father had died. So on the 24th, he made this announcement. And he made it, you could prove that he made it to his cousin on that day and that he heard the news during the night. Now, Lincoln is 150 miles or so from Berkeley Castle. There's no way he could have got to Berkeley and back again in the course of a night to go and check. So this is proof that the information was disseminated in good faith as soon as this information was received. And this information, of course, is the entire basis of the royal family believing Edward II died in Berkeley Castle. Yep. Everybody around the country, all the people who attended Parliament, the commanders on the northern border, everyone got this from that news supplied to the king. Now, if you go over, well, Gloucestershire Archives is over that way somewhere, isn't it? In there is a film of Berkeley Castle Select Rolls CR 39, I think, references, that says that the news was carried by Thomas Gurney in two letters, one for the king and one for the queen being his mother. That news must have left Berkeley Castle on the 21st of September 1327, being delivered at Lincoln on the night of the 23rd, and was then made public on the 24th. Everybody believed it in good faith.
Yeah.
Lord Berkeley later said, as we've already mentioned, I haven't heard, he's dead, the man is dead, until coming into this present Parliament 3 years later. So if he didn't know that the man was dead in 1330, how could he have announced the death in good faith in 1327? So on this basis, I then reconstructed, with this information flow, the narrative that he didn't die in Berkeley Castle. We can be almost certain, as I put it at the time, in 2005, in an article for the English Historical Review, published by Oxford University Press, we can be almost certain that he survived until 1330. Academics didn't know what to think about it, and we were very quiet on the subject for a long time. But because I'm not an academic myself, I don't have an academic position, I'm very critical of academia generally. I think it's very restrictive and a narrow way of thinking about the past. I therefore was sort of marginalized by the people who were in a decision-making position. And it became clear that they were all going to exercise what I now realize is groupthink. I didn't realize it at the time, but I realize now they're reinforcing each other's reluctance to go along with this new narrative.
Yeah.
And so,
I mean, it's a bitter pill to swallow for anybody who's built their life around that.
This is a real problem, which I realize. And, you know, this is why it's so important. Historians are very bad at admitting when they're wrong.
Yes.
Because we trust them to get it right. And so when people do get it wrong in a massive way like this, you'd have to rewrite so much English history from the 14th century to reflect this accurately. Mark Ormerod, who wrote the Yale University Press book on Edward II, said, hey, you may well be right here, but I would have to rewrite the whole first half of my book and revise everything I've written across the entire career to reflect this new narrative. Can't do that.
Yeah. I find it interesting where you say there that historians are very bad suggesting that they may be wrong. I didn't come from a history background. I come from a science background. And scientists cannot wait to be proved wrong. It's really interesting.
Really?
Yeah, because you're like, I have discovered a thing.
Yeah.
And then eventually somebody will go, well, I've discovered a new thing that's kind of advanced that on. And all the science community goes around and goes, that's a great new discovery. Right, well done. The history community is the complete opposite.
Absolutely. It's interesting you say that. I frequently quote a line from Stephen Hawking, you know, the scientific piece of information is only provisionally true because you never know what might come along that puts it in a different context or disproves it or certain circumstances are different.
Yeah. I mean, now, historians should love that. Previously a time where medicine was based around humours and that was right.
Absolutely.
And now we look back on that and not.
Yes, that's one of my other special subjects. But going back to over the second, here we are reducing something. In working out the flow of information, I reduced it to information science, which happened to be my original, you know, I qualified as an archivist before I did my PhD in history. So I actually was on an area of strong knowledge for me, very weak knowledge for most academic historians who are not trained in archival science or information science. And when I tell them certain pieces of information can be reduced to credit card data and proven or not proven, they say, oh, no, you know, history facts aren't like credit card data. You can't. Some are. The credit card shows that you agreed to pay for a certain thing at a certain place at a certain time. Basically, that's all it is. Credit cards did not introduce that means of recording information. We have records of information, records of purchases by specific people in specific places for specific things at specific times, all the way back to 13th century is when I start getting interested. So that information science thing really alienated a lot of them as well. So they resented me making a breakthrough as a non-academic, like popular historians, as they perceived me to be, shouldn't be doing this sort of thing. They had conveniently overlooked the fact that the Royal Historical Society had won the Alexander Prize for the Royal Historical Society. Lots of peer-reviewed research as well. They set all that aside and just look at me as a popular historian and resist this new narrative. And groupthink does take over.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So in 2009, I thought, fuck them. I'm not going to do this any longer. I'm going to put everything I know about this subject into one book called Medieval Intrigue and let it speak for itself. And some people really got it. Some people love medieval intrigue. And for a book with so many endnotes, so many documents cited, such an academic book, I'm flattered it sold 10,000 copies. You know, it's done really well for most academic books struggle to sell 300 copies. So.
Yep.
So I was really pleased with the success of it. But academics carried on ignoring it, even though it's got a very good section which shows why scholars resist proofs. No, it's a chapter called 12 Angry Scholars. I also investigated Edward II in Italy and realized there's an awful lot more you can say about Edward II in Italy than just the Fieschi letter. Now, there's William Galais was a man, probably Edward II, who was brought to Edward III at Cologne, or Koblenz actually, in Germany in 1338. So Edward III met his father 11 years after his father was supposedly done away with, killed. And clearly they got on because Edward III then paid for his father's expenses in advance so that father could be there at the birth of one of his grandchildren in Antwerp, Lionel of Antwerp. This isn't the way you normally behave with imposters. Now, imposter kings normally get, burned to the stake in Europe.
Yeah. Normally they'll burn people for a lot of things in Europe at the time.
Well, this is true. They didn't. They paid his expenses in advance and let him go. And he remained in Italian custody as far as we know. And so I put all that into Medieval Intrigue. It became like a vessel in which I set all my knowledge free for other people. And the irony is that the academics who could have made use of it refused to. and the people who were likely to make bad use of it did. And so it spawned a lot of second-rate thinking, I think. Some good, but an awful lot was bad. And then I came back to this subject again in 2016 when I read a book about the death and burial of Edward II, which didn't even mention my work at all. And it just took the entire traditional narrative as if it was all true. And I just thought, this is just such rubbish. And then I read the academic reviews of that book, and they were all, oh, this is wonderful, blah, blah, blah. And I think, we're paying you, academics, we are paying you. Now, if you're a professor of history now, you're probably on about £100,000 a year or best part of, and you're getting that from the taxpayer, in this case, for pulling the wool over people's eyes. There's a philosopher of history, or a writer on history called Jonathan Gorman, who said the first, I think it's the first purpose or the principal obligation of a historian is to deliver the truth to those who have a right to it. Mm-hmm. Now, if academics up and down the country are not delivering the truth to those who have a right to it, they really should examine their own consciences. And that's why I got involved again. And I started, looking into this. And in 2017, I realized, oh, this is really, really simple. I have missed something so blindingly obvious and so important. I can't believe it. And it came from a book review by an academic. He said, we will probably never know for certain. And I read that line. And I thought, academic history is about how you take evidence. My entire career is about how you take evidence and you analyze it for the information it contains. And then you make, having inferred that information, you are able to say what the limits of that are.
Yeah.
The only way you can say, we never know for certain, is if you're talking about something you don't know about. If you're talking about the past, which is unrecoverable, if you are talking about things where you don't have any evidence, you can't be certain about everything that happened in the past. But where there is evidence, you can be certain what the limits of that evidence are. And that is what led me onto the path that I'm currently battling with various people about, is that, you can prove that the entire way of thinking, the academic way of thinking, the current consensus, the traditional way of thinking is all based on circular argument. Why did people believe that Edward II died in Berkeley Castle? Because there's a massive evidence from the time that says he did. And everybody took it as true.
Yeah.
Lord Berkeley said it's all based on his lie in 1327. So why don't we go along with that and sort of say Lord Berkeley had lied? Well, because there's a massive evidence from the time that says he died. Yeah, that's a circular argument, just going round and round in circles.
Yeah.
Because of the results of Lord Berkeley's lie, everybody is now convinced. But if I were to tell you that I've murdered somebody who's up there in that room, and you went and told everybody else. If I then said, I'm joking. There's nobody dead up there in that room. And you went and everybody said, oh, there's a dead person up there. Now, you wouldn't suddenly have the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I just told you I'd lied. And that's what's happened here. You can't know the truth about something if somebody just lied to you and never told you the truth. So we go around in circle arguments. But many academics and many commentators want there to be circular arguments, they want to trust them, and they make appeals to ignorance, and they mislead people, and that's rather depressing, really.
Which leads on to kind of the wrap-up question, so how has this then debate impacted your understanding of methods, philosophy of history, kind of more broadly?
It's changed my life. I would never have had to become such a sharp methodologist. I would never have had to rethink the principles of history. I would never have had to come to terms really with postmodernism, because most historians can get away, most social historians especially, can get away with avoiding the questions raised by postmodernism. Postmodernism raised some serious questions about whether historians can tell the truth about the past. And most historians can ignore them because people are interested in what they think happened.
Yeah.
Well, you can't. If you're getting involved in a really sharp debate like I've got involved in, you cannot avoid the questions that postmodernism raise, because you have to say what the limits of truth are. How do we know what happened? When you've got something which is as defined, as easily defined as Edward II's death, it's not a relative matter. Manny was either dead or alive. You couldn't have been half.
Yeah.
Wait, there's no way. Either dead or alive. An individual, Edward II, easily identifiable at a certain time. This is credit card data. This is where you start to use information science in the ways that it's not a matter of opinion. So therefore, I had to sort of come up to speed with the philosophy of history. I had to become a better methodologist than everybody else I knew. I had to really upped my game. But it did result in me rethinking the principles of history, which I hope will become published soon as well.
Mm.
Yeah, basically the rules of how you understand the past. And of course, those are the same rules as we use for how you understand the present now. So it's one thing that history could really benefit the whole world is show people how they can tell fact from fiction.
So we have the case then that Edward II doesn't die in 1327 as required. What have you been able to find? And I use the term as required.
I quite like that.
What have you been able to find out that's happened since 1327? That gives Edward II a life that he's been denied.
Right. The outline has to come from Fieschi letters. We don't know of any infill between his supposed death in Berkeley Castle and his emergence in Avignon to go and see Manuel Fieschi. That's a period of about 3 years. According to the Fieschi letter, Edward II was taken to Corfe Castle and secretly imprisoned in a chamber in Corfe Castle.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably not a very nice experience for him. There is some circumstantial evidence that this was the case because Lord Berkeley's own accounts have payments for taking information to letters to John Maltravers at Corfe Castle. So the other keeper has him at Corfe. So the circumstantial evidence that the Fieschi letter is correct. And also, the Earl of Kent tried to rescue Edward II from Corfe Castle. As I say, it probably wasn't a very nice experience for Edward II in Corfe Castle, because there was a survey done by Edward III in 1331. As soon as Edward III got real power, he was a very young man when he came to the throne. He was under Roger Mortimer's control and the control of his mother, Isabella. But when he got real power in 1331, he had a detailed survey made of Corfe Castle. He clearly wanted to know where the dungeon was. The dungeon was above the middle gate in a chamber that has no windows and no door. So Edward II was probably kept in darkness, in solitary confinement, possibly for upwards of 2 years. His half-brother tried to rescue him in March 1330, was betrayed and executed. He confessed, a friar informed him. He confessed to going to see the Pope and telling the Pope that Edward II was secretly imprisoned against terms of Magna Carta, and he would do his best to retrieve him. Other letters have come to light, such as the letter of the Archbishop of York, William Melton, who had certain knowledge that Edward II was still alive in 1330 and making provisions for his escape. But all this was uncovered. Roger Mortimer had Kent charged and in Parliament and executed. By the time Edward Kent was being charged, Edward II had been removed from Corfe Castle. He seems to have been taken to Ireland, which is where Roger Mortimer had vast estates and complete control. He was kept in Ireland until Roger Mortimer fell. And then when Mortimer's fall, his jailer, who'd always looked after him and had custody of him, deserted him. And he was left to do his own thing. He got a boat and he went to Sandwich in Kent. He didn't get off. He then took a boat from Sandwich to Normandy and then went as a pilgrim presumably on foot to Avignon, where he saw, he said in the Fieschi letter, who bribed a servant of the Pope. Well, Cardinal Luca Fieschi, the man who was the boss of Manuel Fieschi, who wrote this letter, was not only one of the most important cardinals, but he was also probably Edward II's second cousin or possibly third cousin. The exact relationship is not clear. Edward II always referred to him as kinsman, my kinsman. And he knew him well. Luca Fieschi had been to England 3 times and spent a lot of time over the second's court. So we're talking about friends as well as relative. Now, he sought Luca Fieschi's custody. So Cardinal Fieschi looked after Edward II, his kinsman, his friends. He took him to Brabant, where Edward II's sole surviving sister was living at the time. He then took him to Cologne to see the Shrine of the Three Kings, one of the most potent sites for medieval religion, especially if you're a king. He then took him to Northern Italy. And he had him lodged with one of his nephews. And when war broke out near that estate, he had him moved to a castle called Oromala, a hermitage near a castle called Oromala in northern Italy for security. That castle was under control of another of his nephews, Niccolo Malaspina, known as Il Marchesotto, so like the warlord for the region. And he was still there in 1336 when the Fieschi letter was written. He was probably still there 2 years later when he was taken to see Edward III in Germany by another member of the Fieschi family. All the time, there is correspondence between Edward III and the Fieschi through the services of a man who's codenamed Cardinal, but his real name was Nicolino Fieschi. And although the Genoese, this is where Edward II is being held by the Fieschi, and all the Fieschi themselves, although they're Genoese, they're on the French side in the Hundred Years' War. Edward III made Nicolino Fieschi a member of his own council, had him as his proctor at the papal court, trusted him implicitly. And of course, this is when the huge amounts of money stopped to change hands. £186,000, roughly six times an annual king's income in England, was handed over to Italian bankers, which was probably why the Pope was able to start building the new palace at Avignon in 1335. Also with this went two crowns. Everybody's always said Edward III was so impoverished he had to pawn the crowns of England to Italian bankers. He wasn't that impoverished. Look at his accounts. He's having lavish events. He did not need to pawn a couple of crowns, but they demanded the crown. Why? Because they got the king. They wanted these symbols of authority as well as the actual land. They were trying to manipulate Edward III into not fighting France. And Edward III came and still was a powerful pawn, but a powerful symbol in the hands of the Fieschi as they tried with the French Pope to stop the Hundred Years' War from breaking out. They failed.
Well, thank you very much for that, Ian. Thank you. That is an absolute massive eye-opener for us. Do you feel better for having got it on?
I talk about it a lot. I write about it a lot. I will feel better when a certain piece of work finally appears in print and published. And everyone can read the stuff themselves because the story is about intrigue and manipulation in the 14th century. But that information is still being a matter of intrigue and manipulation today. And corruption is concerned with, information is subject to corruption in the modern intellectual sense now, just as it was in a political sense back then. And the two have actually got quite a lot in common. So when this all appears in print, then I will feel, yeah, that was a story worth spending 25 years of my life writing.
Well, thank you very much.
And been a pleasure.
I'm happy to do our part to promote that.
Thanks very much.
So, ladies and gentlemen, if you've really enjoyed that and you want to know more about Ian's work, you can and should get a copy of his latest book, Medieval Horizons, Why the Middle Ages Matter, any of the excellent time traveler's guides, or, of course, land yourself a copy of Medieval Intrigue. So I do hope you've enjoyed this episode. We've got more coming for you over the course of the festival. If you've not managed to make it to this year's festival, then it will return in autumn. And those dates are the 14th of September to the 22nd of September, 2024. If you want to support us, please do so. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage, or you can support us on Patreon, where in return for your cherished £5 per month, we will give you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, the opportunity to put questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until our next special, from everyone here at Gloucester History Festival, stay angry. Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.